Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As some of you know, one of the things that I've spoken about the most since visiting China late last year is the fuzzy line between censorship and freedom of speech there these days. The impression my group of journalists got was that there is a fair amount of freedom on their version of Twitter, called Weibo, and elsewhere in many circles to criticize government policy and corruption as long as you don't challenge the legitimacy of the regime itself. So I've been watching with great interest as that fuzzy line was apparently breached last week by a cheeky liberal newspaper called Southern Weekly and the surprisingly major ramifications it seems to be having. So let's talk about the new battle for free speech in China with the new president in place there. Our guest is Keith Richberg, Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post. Keith, welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks. Remind me of the basics. What is the Southern Weekly, and what did they put in this editorial?
Southern Weekly is a weekly newspaper that comes out in Guangdong province. That's the province next to Hong Kong. Listeners might remember it by the old name Canton, but now it's Guangdong. It's always been a little bit...
Whoops, I think we have lost Keith's line. We had a little problem with it before he went on. Keith, you there?
Southern Weekly.
Uh-oh. Okay, I think we're going to have a little problem here. Keith, we'll try it one more time. And if not, we might have to switch up segments and come back to you in a little while. Meanwhile, while we're trying to establish Keith Richberg's line...
I lost you there for a minute.
Yes. Okay, so let's see if we have you back now. You were just starting to describe what this newspaper in Guangdong province, the Southern Weekly, is.
Yeah, it's always been a little bit more liberal, a little bit more kind of in the pro-democracy camp, if you want to say, a little bit more... willing to take risks to criticize the government. What they do every year on New Year's Day is to write a New Year's greetings to its readers. And this year it just sort of said that this year its dream for the new year was a dream for a constitutional democracy in China. After this rather innocuous sort of front page message was written, the editors went home for the night, and someone, and we believe it was a Guangdong provincial propaganda chief, read that editorial or read that message, did not like it, and ordered changes made. He actually rewrote some of the changes himself, basically making it kind of an ode to the Communist Party and a tribute to the Communist Party, which is not what the editors intended. And that's what started this huge protest, first by the staff saying this was, even in China, this was considered very, very intrusive. And then it started getting joined in by many readers, well-known opinion makers, actors, business tycoons, and it became really a free speech issue here in China.
And it's really Orwellian what you describe, because they turned an anti-government editorial into a pro-government editorial.
Absolutely. Even by the standards of Chinese censorship, that was considered something that had never been done before. Actually, to take an editorial that's already been approved by the editors and ready for publication, and the night before the paper is printed, going in and ordering changes to it to change something that's, mildly anti-government and into something that's pro-government. And I guess that's the real key. This is not an anti-government, pro-democracy screed. This was something that could be taken directly from Xi Jinping, the new Communist Party leader, saying we just need more rule of law, more constitutional government. We think it was just this one propaganda official who decided that, no, we have to turn this into a more pro-government, pro-Communist Party piece.
So you think that this incident is the result of the work of one lone bureaucrat as opposed to the new leadership of the country establishing their bottom line?
We're waiting to see how the top leadership, the central government leadership, comes down. What was interesting was this was a relatively isolated case involving what we think was one provincial propaganda chief in Guangdong. But it was, as one media executive here told me, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, the people have been living under this censorship system for so long. This is a huge, modern, sophisticated country, the world's second largest economy, but it's run by a party that still believes it can tell people what they can and cannot read. And so although this incident might have been just chalked down to one, you know, local government official, it's become a rallying cry for everyone who believes that this, you know, that times just have to change. You can't keep censoring what people can read and what people can hear and what people know about.
So how... And how widespread have people been pushing back against the government in support of this newspaper?
A lot of people have showed up, about hundreds showed up outside the offices of this newspaper to lay down chrysanthemum flowers. That's the flower of mourning here in China. The police for several days let this go on unchecked. Recently, they've started now breaking up these demonstrations. It spread further north to here in Beijing, where I am, where the Beijing News, another relatively, you know, tough newspaper, relatively aggressive in their reporting, they were forced to print another newspaper's pro-government editorial, you know, basically supporting censorship. The whole staff was, you know, gathered in the newsroom. It created a real crisis. People were in tears. The editor threatened to resign over this. In the end, they printed a shortened version of this thing that was in there. But, you know, we started to see now the ripple effects of this coming through. People, journalists, first of all, and secondly, readers, and then these public officials and business people going on their internet accounts, their Twitter accounts, saying that, you know, we've had enough of this. That's really what's unusual about this, is the public support.
Now, the Beijing News, that newspaper that you mentioned, that's government-owned, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a relatively hard-charging independent newspaper until about a year and a half ago when it was taken over by the Beijing government's propaganda arm. So now it is technically a government organ. So I think that's why some of the journalists, some of the editors there are not quite used to the fact that they are now a government publication. They have to toe the line a little bit more than they were used to.
But you reported on a very sneaky protest in the Beijing News that had to do with the cooking pages, right?
Absolutely. You know, that's one of the beauties of the Chinese language. You know, there are a lot of words that all sound alike. And so they very creatively have found ways that when you can't talk about the issue at hand, you find a word that sounds like it in Chinese. The name of the Southern Weekly sounds like the word for congee, which is basically leftover rice, porridge. You know, the word for congee porridge and the word for the Southern Weekly newspaper sound similar. So they basically wrote on their food pages in their lifestyle section an ode to the delicious porridge from the South and how it must be very courageous and how it makes us feel warm at night. And, you know, anyone reading that knows that they were saying it was an ode to Southern Weekly, but they could do it all by really writing a tribute to porridge.
That's really pretty fun. By the way, the congee is good. When I was there late last year, that was one of the treats for me, was discovering congee for breakfast. Better than grits.
It's not bad, is it? It's okay. It's all right.
Better than grits. So there's another instance of cracking down on speech, I guess, involving one of your colleagues, but from the New York Times, David Barboza, who, again, when I was there in late November and early December, his article was on everybody's lips. It had just come out, his couple of articles, showing how wealthy the family of the outgoing leader, Wen Jiabo, had become while he was in office. And I see that David Barboza's visa has not been renewed. Even though he was a Shanghai-based reporter for a number of years, I had heard he was, had pretty good relations with the government from you know, what I hear from people. And yet this article came out that they're not questioning the accuracy of, but boom, David Barboza is out.
The Times has now had a couple of visa issues. I know that their newly appointed bureau chief, Phil Pan, a former Washington Post colleague of mine, has been applying for a visa to be the bureau chief for the New York Times here for about 8 or 9 months, and we've not heard anything yet on that visa as well. So, you know, this is a way, the visa is the way that the government here uses to kind of show displeasure with articles that they don't like. They very rarely actually expel someone directly, someone who's here and accredited and gets kicked out of the country. The last time that happened was in May when an American woman, Melissa Chan, working for Al Jazeera, was kicked out. But what we're starting to see now is they're starting to get very annoyed by the fact that the foreign press is being very aggressive in covering the wealth of the leadership, the family members of the leaders, and then how they've accumulated wealth. And so I think, you know, they never actually outright deny visas as much as they just delay them. So that's kind of a standard operating procedure here. We've all gotten used to the kind of the daily visa hassles here. We're all on a one-year visa. It has to be renewed every December. So that because it's now January, you're starting to see people who are at least delayed in getting their visas renewed.
So Al Jazeera gets kicked out by the government of China and by Time Warner Cable in the United States.
That's right.
That's a couple of interesting badges of honor there. But before you go, the big picture. Again, when I was there, and it was my first time in China, but one of the other journalists with me from The Atlantic who had been there 10 years earlier said that he was amazed at the change for the better with respect to free speech, that even though, you know, newspapers can't directly criticize the government, people can't organize against the government, that it seemed much freer in terms of elites being able to talk to each other. The Chinese version of Twitter, Weibo, includes a lot of people saying a lot of things, again, as long as they don't directly challenge the legitimacy of the government. And so that over a 10-year period, the trend is toward the much more free in terms of speech. Is that your impression?
Absolutely. You know, my first trip to China was 1985. After that, I came here to China a lot during between the period 1995 and 2000. I was here, you know, for a very long trip, sometimes 6 weeks. I lived in Hong Kong during the time, and then I'm back now. So between those periods of time, it's night and day comparison. I mean, newspapers now are relatively aggressive at covering a lot of different topics, environmental issues, environmental problems, pollution issues, you know, chemicals being dumped in the rivers, local level corruption among local officials who are corrupt. Newspapers seem to have great leeway at covering a lot of these topics. There are just a few kind of red lines, and one of those red lines is, of course, the leadership, the legitimacy of the communist system. As long as you're not questioning the legitimacy of the system, as long as you're not questioning the Communist Party's right to rule, and as long as you're not touching the inner circle of the ruling Politburo, there's great leeway here among the media people to basically investigate, to explore, to do what they want. And on Weibo, as you mentioned, the Chinese version of Twitter, I'm amazed at kind of the topics that are open for debate and discussion there. It's become kind of like the country's water cooler, where everybody can talk out on pretty much any topic except anything dealing with separatism and the Dalai Lama in Tibet. But a lot of topics are out there for display, and corruption is a huge one. And I think in some ways the central government relies on this kind of Weibo and this kind of internet activity as really a way to let people vent some frustrations.
And we will see. It's one of the big questions, I'm sure, facing the new government there, how much to further loosen the reins and how much to tighten. But we leave it there with Keith Richberg, the Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post. Really interesting. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on. You can take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, Vivek Bald on South Asian immigrants passing as one race or another in the United States. His book is called Bengali Harlem. Stay with us.